This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch the show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Citing public safety, Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh ordered the removal of four Confederate statues from her city overnight early Wednesday morning, hours after President Donald Trump once more came to the defense of Nazi demonstrators in Charlottesville, Virginia. The Baltimore City Council had voted just a day earlier to remove the statues. The question of whether white supremacists, Nazis, and self-proclaimed fascists have the right of free speech when they represent the vilest ideologies, ranging from racial domination to genocide, is an important one. The American Civil Liberties Union has come under fire for suing Charlottesville in defense of the right of the Nazis and their affiliates to march in the city's downtown area last weekend. But in light of Heather Heyer's killing and DeAndre Harris's beating, did the fascists have the right to march? Indeed, the so-called alt-right have already planned many more marches in cities around the country. And with the president egging them on, isn't public safety in peril? My guest is Corey Brettschneider, professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, as well as Trump versus the Constitution. Welcome to the show, Corey.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So this issue of free speech is such a fraught one. It should be simple that, you know, we protect free speech. But when it comes to those people who actually want to inflict harm on others, it becomes much thornier. We know, for example, it's illegal, I understand, and you can correct me, to go into a crowded theater and yell fire if there's no fire, right?
Correct, yes. Well, I mean, that's a famous line from a case called Schenck, now used a lot, but originally coined by Justice Holmes to suggest that there are indeed, as you say, some limits to free speech when violence is imminent.
So in light of what happened at Charlottesville, we can sort of retrospectively have the discussion, but shouldn't we have known that there was going to be violence when ahead of Charlottesville in, say, Berkeley, there was a counter-protester who was shot by one of these members of these groups. And the groups that showed up in Charlottesville have not attempted to really mask who they are. They are with the KKK, which, you know, has a pretty clear violent history. They've sported swastikas, which is a symbol of a genocidal ideology. Some of them call themselves fascists. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an ideology of violence toward the rest of us that doesn't deserve free speech?
It's a great question. I think it's one of the most important that we're facing now. And I should say, just send my condolences to the family of the counter-protester, the woman who died in this tragic event, and also just to express my horror with you, what's happening around the country, that there is this emboldened, and yes, we just have to say it for what it is, fascist, Nazi, and in many instances, the Ku Klux Klan of yesteryear rising its ugly head again. Now, we have this very difficult question, which is how are we going to deal with their rights of expression? And the law right now, I think, is very clear, which is that in our system, we have a rule called viewpoint neutrality. And what it says at its core is that we cannot punish people for their opinions, no matter how heinous. And there's a long history of that. It partly comes from protecting the left, communists who were under siege in the early part of the century and arrested for their ideology. Fought back, lawyers fought back, and eventually the judiciary said in a case called Brandenburg that was about the Klan that imminent violence is one thing, that can be stopped, but we're not going to stop people as a result of their ideology from coming out and marching. So there are two very important cases on this issue in addition to the Brandenburg case. One is called Virginia versus Black, and there what the court said was that the Ku Klux Klan, if they're having a rally, basically, and it's, you know, an expression of their hateful ideology, the awful things that they stand for, in particular, their opposition to the idea of equality under law, the formation of their organization is based around that ideal resistance to the Equal Protection Clause. They still, the court said, have a right to express the opinion. Now, that's very different from questions where violence is either imminent or where there's a direct threat. So in that same case, they said, if an individual, and they looked at a case just like this, was burning a cross on the lawn of a family in order to threaten them and to send the message, we're going to come get you, true threats are not protected under our Constitution, and neither is imminent violence. So that's the distinction.
So it's...
I agree with some caveats.
So then it's a matter of whether the gathering in Charlottesville, the so-called alt-right, promised violence or not, right? The Daily Stormer, this neo-Nazi, I prefer the term straight-up Nazi, website, said that they declared this summer a summer of hate. The groups that gathered came well armed. They promoted arming themselves. They brought shields. Shouldn't all of that have been very clearly a message that they were bringing imminent violent harm on people?
Yes, I mean, in retrospect, that's certainly true. And, you know, the court has left and the Constitution leaves room to, of course, protect people from imminent violence and from true threats. So on my view, you know, the court can restrict the place of the demonstration, the time of it. And I think that, yes, there was an error in not allowing the mayor of Charlottesville, who has been doing an amazing job, I think, in trying to navigate the situation, of doing what he wanted, which was to root the alt-right, as they call themselves, to another place. On the issue of guns, I think we've got to grapple with that as well. I guess there's some expressive function in carrying a gun, but to me it's outweighed by the danger that's posed in the context of a demonstration like this. So, you know, I think that there could have been, and there needs to be more attention to, yes, protecting. I agree with the court in these cases that opinion should not be silenced as a matter of criminal law. We shouldn't punish people for their opinion. But we can, apart from issues of discriminating against a specific opinion, protect people. And so limiting the ability to display weapons in marches and also caring about the location and with an aim towards careful planning and the avoiding of future violence. I think those things are permissible within our jurisprudence.
Right. I mean, last year when the Republican National Convention took place, there was a decree by the Secret Service that people couldn't come with their weapons on display or with their weapons at all within a certain perimeter because, you know, the Republican candidate's safety was at stake. What about just the public safety, right? I want to talk about the ACLU because this is really important. And the ACLU is a really important organization. It's been around for a long time, defended many people and almost always is on the right side of issues, almost always. I owe my U.S. citizenship to the ACLU, actually, but that's another story. But in the case of Charlottesville, ahead of Charlottesville's weekend event, the city was asking to, and this is Governor Terry McAuliffe said on NPR earlier this week, the city of Charlottesville asked for that to be moved out of downtown Charlottesville to a park about a mile and a half away, to a park with a lot of open fields. That was the place where it should have been. We were unfortunately sued by the ACLU. The judge ruled against us. That rally should not have been in the middle of downtown. And the ACLU shot back quite angrily, saying that they were not responsible for the violence in Charlottesville. Why did the ACLU come to their defense? I mean, they could have put out a statement saying they supported them, but they sued the city. They aggressively defended the right of the Nazis.
Yeah. I mean, they are devoted, as am I, to the principle that we do not punish opinion. And so it's incumbent on them to try to defend people who have, frankly, heinous, the worst views. So, you know, in the past, they've defended the Nazis' right to march. I don't know if they did the Skokie, Illinois case, but that's another important case. The Nazis wanted to march through a Jewish neighborhood, and the court upheld their right to do so. And the idea in these cases was that, you know, we don't punish opinion. Now, you say, well, what about just moving the march? And I think that's a really important point. My understanding and the nuance of the case is that what the ACLU raised was a question of whether there was discrimination going on in the permitting, in particular denying permits to the alt-right and granting them to other groups. And that, again, is what discrimination when it comes to the right to protest.
But the other groups weren't promising violence, and the alt-right was promising violence.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, it's very hard to argue with you in retrospect. Now that we know what happened, I think...
I mean, so here's my issue with the ACLU. you can support in principle the right of, you know, crazy people to do what they want, or say what they want rather, but why throw your legal weight to make it happen? I mean, the ACLU saw a spike in donations after the Trump administration came into power from largely progressives, and they used part of that money to defend the right of Nazis to trample on people's heads and shove cars into them and violently beat people up. I mean, frankly, personally speaking, my opinion is that I'm ashamed of the ACLU for doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll defend them a little. And I think, as you say, they're doing the most important work in fighting, some of the most important work in fighting the Trump administration. Their view, I think, and the reason to see their intervention or the defense of it, is that you defend the Constitution and you defend the rule. And that means not just defending it when it's protecting the people who you agree with. And certainly the ACLU does not agree with the substance of the Nazis' position. But protecting their right as a matter of free speech is what preserves the rule. And the rule is, at least when it comes to punishment, no discrimination based on the view. Look at what the Trump administration is doing, for instance, where they're starting to investigate people who joined up for a website that was involved in protests.
Right.
The worry about that is that, again, right, they're intervening based on the viewpoint. So that's the idea, that at least when it comes to punishment, and I'll say more about, I think there are ways within the existing rules to do more than we are to combat hate speech. There are lots of opportunities to do so. But their core principle, I think, is the right one, which is that we defend the right to speech, period, even when we don't agree with it.
Okay. I mean, defending is one thing, but actually pouring resources into this, you know, to pouring resources into Nazi pockets. They spent the money that the Nazis didn't have to.
Justice Ginsburg, when she pioneered the idea that the Equal Protection Clause applies to women as well as to men, that it prohibits gender discrimination, she and her allies litigated on behalf of men. Now, you could say, well, why were they litigating on behalf of men? And the idea was it was a strategy to try to move the law in a direction that it would ultimately, in the end, be protective of women. Now, I think what the ACLU's position has always been in all of these cases, and it's very hard to swallow, you know, given what just happened, but is that we're protecting the right to free speech, period. And we don't just protect it in the instance in which we agree with the people.
But free speech isn't physical violence.
I agree with that, yeah.
And so now let's talk about moving forward.
I don't want to overstate our, right, you know, our differences. The court has the ability to say that when it comes to imminent violence and when it comes to where the location of the marches are, it can say, you know, you're going to be over here and we're going to be over here and this group's going to be there, or wait till 3 o'clock. And in the past, courts have been very willing to do that, you know, in protests at the conventions, for instance, where they've overextended, I think, those limits.
Right. Sure,
they should in the future. And I think in retrospect, yes, should have separated these groups and done much more to protect the violence. And I just want to emphasize, they can do that without abandoning the core principle that the ACLU is defending, which is that we do not punish people based on their viewpoints, no matter how heinous.
Now, let's talk about moving forward, because these right-wing fascist and Nazi groups, you know, emboldened by Trump, have promised more Charlottesvilles. They are coming to a city near you. They have planned, I think, 9 cities where they're going to be gathering and bringing their hate and violence. Christopher Cantwell, who is one of these Nazi leaders, in a documentary on by Vice News, the day after Heather Heyer's killing, said to the journalist, "Our rivals are a bunch of stupid animals. I think it was more," meaning Heather Heyer's death, "was more than justified. I think a lot more people are gonna die before we're done here, frankly." This is Christopher Cantwell telling the Vice News reporter what he thinks, literally minutes after he took four or five guns off of his own body and put them onto the hotel bed where he was speaking to her. In light of what he has said and what others have said, should the courts, should the ACLU consider that these groups have the right of free speech when public safety is so clearly at risk?
Yeah, I mean, we have to look at the facts in the particular march. I don't think that we can taint all of these marches, which of course I oppose, and I think the government has an an obligation, I should say, to oppose them. And part of what's heinous about Donald Trump's statements over the last few days is that he's failed in the core constitutional obligation to condemn and to discourage and to deeply criticize them. But having said that, I still think that the obligation of the government is to both condemn and also to protect these groups. So I don't think we can taint all marches by the right with the brush of this extremist interview. I think we have to look in the instance and ask, is violence imminent in this area or not? We can do things like, I think the courts absolutely need to do things like limit the right to display guns in these marches. And they also have to think very carefully about the location and the time. But again, you know, the option that we face is, and it's a real option, I don't want to underplay it, is to go the way of the rest of the world. In the rest of the world, it's very easy, these cases. The Nazi Party is banned, and we could just outlaw them and criminalize it. Now, in our system, we have a First Amendment, we have free speech, so I think we have to, without abandoning that, protect the right to hear these heinous views and also come up with strategies, including a strong governmental response to condemn them. So the mayor of Charlottesville, I think, Mike Signer, what he's done is take a lead by saying, you know what, it's one thing to allow these people to march, but we have to send a very clear message that white supremacy and the Klan and the Nazi Party are outside the values of the United States and that they have no place here. And we have to begin to persuade people to abandon and certainly not move towards those groups. I think that if we go the way of the rest of the world, it drives them underground, it makes them more extreme, and it loses the ability to engage them. And as difficult as it's going to be over the next few years, I don't want to see us go the way of just outlawing groups with even heinous views.
So let's talk about the Confederate statues as well. Some would argue that the tearing down of Confederate statues is violating the free speech rights of the Confederates. Trump basically defended the preservation of Confederate statues, saying, are we going to, you know, tear down every single statue of every single slave owner? You know, some might respond, yes, that would be fine. But for example, in the case of Baltimore, the city council voted to do so. And before they could, before there could be, you know, sort of a public response, because some left-wing groups had decided to follow the example of Durham, North Carolina, and actually tear down the statues themselves, the city did it. And they did it very swiftly, and I think quite effectively, you know, take away the impetus for right-wing groups to come and march on them. Does that skirt the issue of free speech at all? Does that actually infringe on anyone's free speech rights when a city does that?
I think it's a great question. I've actually written a book about this called When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? Well before any of these events unfolded. And my view
is... And that's
is,
why we're having you on the show.
Exactly. And my view is that absolutely it is the obligation, not just the ability or the power of the government to take these statues down, but it's absolutely the obligation. If we're going to have this, and you know, you and I went back and forth on this. We had a good discussion about it and a hard one, about whether or not we're going to protect these groups from putting them in prison for their views. I think we shouldn't over-criminalize. We criminalize enough, and we should protect these groups. But if we're going to do that—
Let me just clarify. I certainly didn't argue that they should be imprisoned for their speech.
Right.
My argument was that they shouldn't have resources poured into them by privately funded organizations like the ACLU and maybe not allowed to just simply march.
Right.
Yeah.
And I didn't mean to imply that you were. But I guess the ACLU's position is that what they're doing is not defending the groups. They're defending this rule, which is— unique. I mean, I don't want to make light of it. The rest of the world just bans these groups outright. And in this country, we have this bizarre, unique, American exceptionalist, if you want to call it, rule that says you don't go to prison for denying the Holocaust. In Germany, you would go to prison for that. Now, my view is, and I want to put pressure on that, I don't think it's obvious that we should have that rule. I think if we are going to have it, and this comes back to your question, we have to require, I should say, the government, both in the presidential statements, but also in things like monuments, to send a message that racism is out of place in the American system. And that means taking down symbols of hate, like Confederate monuments, like the Confederate battle flag that you sometimes see on license plates. So it's not just a power of the government. It's certainly not a free speech violation. It's more than that. It's an obligation in this unique system, this unusual system, where we protect even hateful viewpoints, that the government has to take an active role in condemning, criticizing, and changing those views so that it's clear that they should disappear.
And actually, let's finally clarify what the First Amendment says, because whenever you have fights over who can say what, people will hold up, you know, it's my First Amendment right to say this, that, and or the other. Who is obligated to respect someone's free speech rights? Isn't it just the government being unable to discriminate between speech, but private individuals, groups, even corporations can exercise their free speech rights to boycott, cancel events, etc. So let's clarify what it means when we say someone has a free speech right to say what they want to say.
Yeah, certainly you and I don't have to seek, and should not seek, the association of Nazis. We don't have to approve or tolerate them. We could send the message of strong condemnation. And the First Amendment is a limit on what government can do.
So, now, for example, if I refuse to interview a Nazi, it's my right.
Say it again.
If I refuse to interview a Nazi, they don't have the right to be on the air.
Yes. I mean, look, I think that sometimes, like in that Vice video that we were talking about, you learn things by watching it. And I've learned a lot by that really heroic reporter that sat through that. And it made me sick to my stomach. I could see she was sick to her stomach. But drawing out the view, instead of just, you know, prohibiting it, I think it taught us something about what we're up against.
Sure.
And so I was glad to see her do it.
Sure.
On university campuses, there are limits. I mean, I think that there is a free speech question about whether or not, if a student group, for instance, invited Ann Coulter to Berkeley, there is a very serious legal question about whether Berkeley would have the right to cancel that talk based not on questions of violence, but based on her viewpoint. They cannot. Now, she is a vile also in her viewpoint, but I think that's another instance where we have to permit the speech and find ways to protest.
Is that because Berkeley is a state school, a private institution, would have been okay in canceling?
It's more complicated in the private instance, but it's clear in the Berkeley case that's right, because it is a government institution. And this isn't just a matter of one level of government. It's the free speech limit applies to all levels of government.
But again, of course, if it can be proven for there to be a threat of imminent violence, then it does sort of complicate it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the lessons here for government around the country, and in the Berkeley case, I think this is true too, is you obviously, if you have to see the risks that come with this enormous free speech right. And there are major risks. And one of the risks is violence. And so planning around that, putting the resources into a trained police force that knows how to deal with these circumstances. As I said, moving and coordinating the protests in a way that limits the risks of violence is fundamental. But one thing I think that we shouldn't do, not just can't, is just ban dangerous or extremist viewpoints.
Well, Corey, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your insight and the legal expertise you bring to this.
Thank you.
Corey Brettschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality. We've been discussing whether fascists and Nazis have free speech rights. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.